Hi, this is Barry Liss at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. What role should operations research play in intelligence? That is a question that was posed in two reports by the Pentagon's Defense Science Board. This February, the Board's Task Force on Defense Intelligence issued a report on counterinsurgency and ISR, Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance. The report discussed operations research. Earlier, in 2009, the Board's Advisory Group on Defense Intelligence issued a report dedicated to operations research applications for ISR. In today's segment, we talk to retired Air Force Major General Richard O'Leary, currently with Sage Intelligence Associates. The General is co-chair of the task force that produced both reports. General, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's begin by looking at the new report, but before we do, please tell our listeners what the Defense Science Board is and what your task force does.
The Defense Science Board is a formally instituted by law advisory group to the Secretary of Defense, who responds to the Undersecretary for Acquisitions, Technology, and Logistics. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's Dr. Ash Carter. The Defense Science Board consists of several panels each year, and the panels are each given the task to look at, whether it's how safe are our nuclear weapons or what is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance for counterinsurgency or any of it, you know, how can we improve access to space? A lot of different topics. Generally speaking, there'll be three or four of these panels any one year that will be looking at particular topics of great interest to the Department of Defense.
Vice President Biden was at the center of discussion about whether to use counterterrorism or counterinsurgency methods in Afghanistan. Your report deals mostly with the latter. Can you explain the difference between counterterrorism and counterinsurgency?
If I could do that, I'd probably be in a position to compete for vice president.
Oh.
what we found in engaging in this report was that a lot of people do not completely understand the distinctions between the two, and they view them as separate and distinct rather than events that can be occurring simultaneously. Let me put it kind of simplistically, and these are by no means authoritative definitions. The report contains a lot of different definitions on both terms, COIN and counterterrorism. Counterterrorism in simplistic form is to eliminate terrorists within the area we're talking about. In this case, it would have been in Afghanistan. How to eliminate terrorists in Afghanistan? You can phrase it that way. That means you would want to kill or destroy or capture the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That's one way of looking at it. The idea there being that it doesn't take as many troops and it doesn't take as long to identify, target, and neutralize those terrorists. On the other side of the equation is counterinsurgency, which most of our task force, I think, would agree is a very negative term because you're reacting to something mm-hmm. rather than doing it proactively. But counterinsurgency presumes that you eliminate causes of grievance in the population, whether it's lack of schooling, lack of health, lack of financial stability or corruption in the government or whatever it turns out to be. There's some cause of grievance which causes a certain element of the population to rise up and go contrary to the established government's interest. Is Afghanistan a counterinsurgency is another issue to be discussed at a different time. But counterinsurgency, by most models, say it takes a factor of X counterinsurgent people to take care of X terrorists or ex-insurgents. And that number is much higher by orders of magnitude than it would do to just go out and do counterterrorism operations where you're focusing on the bad people. In counterinsurgency, what you have to do is eliminate those sources of grievance, but one of the things you have to do is provide protection. You have to provide capabilities. utilities, schools, medical supplies, those kind of things. So it requires a much larger footprint on the ground, and hence a much larger military presence if you're going to use a military instrument or power to do that. And that's kind of stylistically. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you're doing all of one at one time and all of the other another time. You can be doing both simultaneously.
And what led to this report being commissioned and delivered? In particular, what did Major General Michael T. Flynn write about the failure of counterinsurgency in Afghanistan?
I don't want to put words in General Flynn's mouth, but I will, by recollection, tell you what I thought of the report. The report, he said, in the report he wrote, he said, basically, we don't understand enough in context about the population there to do counterinsurgency very effectively or counterterrorism very effectively. Because one of the sources of information to go after terrorists in a counterterrorism mode is the population. And the population has to trust you, has to be willing to share information with you, and not be worried about reprisals if they do share information. So if you can't provide them stability and protection, they're not going to share. And hence, this is a do loop you get into that you can't get there from here. Mm-hmm. So what, one of his criticisms was we are sending people over there, intelligence analysts and collectors, who don't understand the dynamics of the population-centric information we've got to handle to do both counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. And when he wrote that report and published it, it got a lot of publicity. It got a lot of reactions from people in the DOD, from people in other aspects of the government, because it was viewed as a criticism for our operations there.
As a child of the 60s, I was struck by a quote in the set of observations and recommendations. This was, I think, point number 7. The report says that insurgency has been the most prevalent form of armed conflict since at least 1949, but despite that fact, following the Vietnam War and through the balance of the Cold War, the U.S. military establishment turned its back on insurgency. Why was that, and what does the task force recommend in terms of solutions in the light of that?
There are those who would say, and this is another art form and a very doctrinally embedded thing in the military psyche, and that is doing counterinsurgency requires a certain set of skills for the military. They're not all find, fix, targeting, and destroy the enemy, which is a very traditional military skill set. And which, during, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, the era of Vietnam, that was kind of a sideshow to the big Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. That really, the Cold War really encompassed more of the traditional military skill sets, which required a lot of intelligence, which required a lot of firepower, and which really, at the root of the problem, really meant the saving of the national security, the saving of our way of life, because the Soviet Union could have eliminated that. The story with counterinsurgency, starting at least with Vietnam, if not earlier, and since then, is that those are sideshows. Those are distractions from our main line of business, which is to protecting the vital interests of our national security and survival, which Vietnam, whatever you read in history books, probably wasn't going to ever jeopardize the national security and safety of the United States. So the military is very interested in getting in, getting out, and getting back to the real purpose of the military, which is national security and survival of the United States. And so there's a doctrinal issue there that we like to have doctrine. We like to know what we're doing. And as soon as the sideshow was over, we got back to the mainstream. And what you see going on now in the last 10 years is, again, the ascendancy of special operations, which is almost synonymous with not the mainstream military, the big counter China, whatever it turns out to be the near peer is today, but the counterinsurgency, the small wars. And so again, you see the rise of credibility, of potency of the special operations personnel. And in fact, General Flynn comes up through the special operations side of the Army.
Let's look at the findings and recommendations in the report, especially those related to ops research and related technologies. One finding, I think it was number 8, talks about the deluge of sensor data creating a crisis in processing, exploitation, and dissemination, or PED, of useful intelligence. And another finding, it was number 9, points out that new and emerging technologies and techniques can be employed to improve understanding of counterinsurgency environments. Coming around to operations research, or ops research as it's referred to in the military, does our ops research have a role to play in addressing these two points, these issues?
You've asked a mouthful of questions there. We could take a long time to talk about those two things. Let's start with number eight, the deluge of information. The information we're getting today on a wide range of subjects, first of all, the question is, what is your requirement to collect information? What do you want to collect it on? If we narrow it down to just Afghanistan, that makes it a little bit easier. But if you say the United States is a global power and has to be aware of things going around in 200 countries in the world, that's a big problem. So you've got a large appetite or a large requirement there to collect data. Most people, when they hear this deluge of data, think of in terms of imagery, that we're collecting full motion video or electro-optical imagery or something else that is on the imagery side of things. But if you look at the Arab Spring, you find out that what we would call open source information, social media, there was a lot of criticism that the United States wasn't doing open source intelligence better. That's a tough chore because it requires a lot of collection, a lot of analysis. Signals intelligence, human intelligence, all those different kinds of intelligence feeds require, what is the requirement? What do you need me to collect against specifically? So that's the first challenge. The second challenge is, and that's really the easiest challenge or the easier mm-hmm. challenge. The other challenge is, once I've collected this, what do you want me to do with it all? And how do I bring it together to provide a meaningful whole? If the job of intelligence, simplistically stated, is to provide information to decision makers which reduces their risk and uncertainty. And so intelligence reduces risk and uncertainty for a decision maker, whether it's the president or the sergeant in the foxhole, then you've got an output function. You know, we're starting to introduce OR terms now, inputs and outputs. Uh-huh. And then the conversion mechanism in the middle is what we in the paper talked about as the processing, exploitation, dissemination. How do you get a piece of data or several pieces of data through this PED process to become useful intelligence? When you collect so much information, how do you find the meaningful from the noise? For example, as a report says, there are 660 million people on Facebook. If you were able to collect all that information, and I'm not saying we do, but if you were able to, how do you sort through it all? And you can find the same thing for imagery or human intelligence or other things. So the first question from an OR standpoint is, on the input side, what vehicles do I want to have to do that collection? Let's just stick with imagery. Do I want to have a satellite? Do I want to have a manned airplane? Do I want to have an unmanned airplane? Do I want it to be this kind of sensor on it or not? And the earlier report, and many times since then, we've talked about OR can be used to pick the right collection sources.
And we will talk about the earlier report in a little while.
And then you get back to the problem of on the PED issue, how do you absorb all that data, find the meaningful tidbits that are actionable intelligence? Technology, whether it's operations research mechanisms, whether it's modeling and simulation, can be used to help you find the nuggets in there. And technology, for example, how do you filter through reams and reams of video information from foreign TV stations? Or how do you filter through reams of uncataloged imagery information and find just the picture you're looking for at just the right place at just the right time? And that's where there are lots of trades that can be made using the scientific methods that decision-making tools like OR give you.
Turning to a specific section of the report that deals with operations research, it was in section 3.4.2. It says, and I quote, "It's important to recognize the intensity of the resource limitations under which the DoD is operating, the growing severity of these limitations, and the enormous costs to sustain current operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. However, improvements, modest in their costs, can be undertaken immediately. These improvements include more use of systems analysis, operations research, and planning efforts to improve the efficiencies of TTPs, which is short for Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures, and limited ISR resources and better inter-service coordination." So if you could, explain this recommendation about ops research, and if you could just elaborate on it a little bit.
In the great scheme of things, I view, I'm a simplistic person, I'm not an operations research specialist, but I would put it in the toolkit that says, here is a decision-making tool that can be used however appropriately by decision makers at whatever level on whatever problem they have to do something which is quasi-scientific, is repeatable, which should give you the same answer if you put the same variables in, mm-hmm. which should give you comfort. The human enterprise is not one that's very scientific. So in the absence of a decision-making tool that can help gather information, structure the information, rule out biases or identify biases and make you make assumptions that are explicitly stated so they can be changed and see what difference that mm-hmm. has. I see the strength in OR or modeling and simulation or systems analysis as being to make explicit all the variables in your decision-making process. In the absence of such a decision tool, which is, again, a scientific type tool, in the absence of that, you find the human nature of people will say, I'm doing this because I have the experience, I've learned by experience the knowledge that allows me to intuitively tell you the right answer. And that may be good for most situations, but when you're dealing with national security, particularly when you're dealing with very, very high consequence operations, you want to be sure you're not going just on the seat of pants of someone's intuition. When you're dealing with buying very expensive weapon systems, whether they're collection systems or analysis systems, you want to be sure that you are not using just one man's intuition, but rather identifying for critical analysis all the variables that have gone into the equation. Now, I'm not saying OR is the answer to everything, but it is certainly
but it helps.
An organizing tool to mm-hmm. get you and anybody else who has a stake in the issue to put up their assumptions, their data, and subject them to scientific scrutiny.
Picking up a little bit on what we're discussing in terms of purchasing systems, you've said that you're a strong proponent of OR and that you hope the government will begin to use it more as the budget process forces us to make some major cuts. How can ops research be used by DOD and Defense Intelligence at a time when budget deficits are dominating discussion on Capitol Hill?
Well, I would say if you go back to the report we did 2 years ago and looked at some of the highlights from it, there are probably two or three points, maybe four, to be made. Number one is, the organization ought to recognize that they need a decision-making tool as an organizational mechanism, as a mechanism that approaches scientific quality judgments mm-hmm. and that isn't subject to political vagaries, which is always going to be there. That's point number one. Point number two, it throws in the issue of when you're judging trade studies, what metrics are you using? Now, if we go back to the earlier question on counterterrorism versus counterinsurgency, what metric might be how many bad people did we kill or how many attacks did they mount, as opposed to how many people are now going to school, how many people are now getting their shots, how many people are paying their taxes or whatever else the measure of merit is. So one of the issues that we have struggled with in the department, particularly on the ISR area, is what is the metric that you're using to choose one system versus another or one intelligence discipline versus another? And as we draw down and have more budget constraints, that will become a more and more important factor, I think.
We've referred a lot to the 2009 report, and perhaps we could turn to it now. It's a report on OR applications for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. In a memo accompanying the report, you and your co-chair wrote that ops research was a powerful tool with a lot of potential for defense intelligence applications, but that it was being used inconsistently within the defense establishment. What strong potential did you see, and what were the inconsistencies?
When you look at a lot of the defense, Department of Defense rules and policy guidelines, it calls for the use of OR in these big decision cases. again, trying to take out the subjective ones and identify and have open to public critique, open critique, what factors went into the decisions. What we found at that time was that a lot of people were saying, well, we're using OR. One of the first issues that we really had to spend a lot of time grappling with on that first 2009 report was, what is OR? What is a good definition for OR? And we actually spent probably 2 months trying to nail down, and we had some very good help doing it. Some very knowledgeable people in the OR business helped us trying to narrow down and bound the problem of what is a good definition for OR. And once you do that, you start then saying, okay, well, how could OR be used, and how is OR being used? Then the next question is, well, you want to take inventory of what OR capabilities does the government have? What hardware and software, what numbers of people, how are the people trained, are they certified, what is their role in the professional community of ops research, and what have we done in that area since the anti-submarine warfare business of World War II? Mm-hmm. You know, and everyone is very familiar with what happened there and how that played a large part in winning World War II. What you'll find and what we found is a lot of people paid lip service to OR, claimed that they checked it off in the process of buying this, that, or something else, but in reality, they defined OR in a manner that would not meet our test for what OR is. Mm-hmm. They didn't clearly identify the stakeholders. It was a very much of an ad hoc business. They didn't identify the assumptions. They didn't identify metrics. They didn't identify all the different variables and factors that were used in the metrics they built. And so to us, that wasn't OR, even though people claim that they're doing OR. Another metric was what's happened to the population of OR experts in the DoD. And we went through the services and found out that we weren't putting the same emphasis on demanding X number of people in the Navy, Army, and Air Force be trained in OR skills and given advanced education in those skills. Mm-hmm. So those were just kind of a couple of glimpses at the status of OR in the government. And so it was not consistently, despite all the lip service, it wasn't consistent in how it was being used.
The executive summary said, quote, the task force believes OR should be institutionalized, practiced consistently from a standards and methodology perspective, and used routinely to support high-value decisions involving complex requirements and significant resources. What kind of high-value decisions were you talking about there?
What we're talking about there, in just to give you one example, would be the acquisition of a major intelligence system. There you have a whole bunch of trade studies you're looking for. Are you looking for a satellite system which is relatively impervious because it can circle a country without that country's permission over and over again, but is very expensive and perhaps limited in terms of the payloads it can carry and the length of time it's going to be there? Or are you looking at an airplane that has a pilot on board, and as soon as you introduce the man in the equation, then you have all kinds of
potential casualty.
Yeah, you have potential casualties. You have the human factors limitations. Biologically, that person can only last so long in the airframe before he or she gets tired. Or you can say, well, I can do it with an unmanned airplane. So right there, we've given you three major ways to look at it, by satellite, by a manned airplane, by an unmanned airplane. And then you get into nuances of differences of if it's got to be survivable. Well, a satellite's pretty survivable. A manned airplane is pretty survivable unless somebody's shooting at you or unless it's very stealthy. An unmanned airplane, you're not as inclined to worry about losing it if you don't have a man on board or a woman on board. So these are all dynamics in the equation of what's the solution or what is the proper mix of those solutions. If you need to stay on a target for 30 hours consecutively or 30 days consecutively, satellites have a hard time doing that. Manned airplane has a real hard time doing that. And then an unmanned airplane, unless it's in a very permissive environment, might have a hard time doing that. Or unless it's flying in a country where either they don't know about it or they don't care about it, that's another factor. So when you make just a simple, quote, simple decision such as that one, what vehicle do I want to use?
And then the next question is, what kind of payloads do I want to have in that vehicle? Do I want to have signals intelligence? Do I want to have imagery intelligence? Some other kind of intelligence system on the airplane. Mm-hmm. And that's where OR can help you make those, here are the merits of this system and the downcoming, the shortcomings of it. Here are the merits of this one. And then start introducing cost and benefit analysis. And I think that's probably a simplistic example, but a relatively good one.
We'll go into the details of the report a little bit. The report uses Federal Express as a private sector example that the Department of Defense could follow. What lessons were you looking at from FedEx?
We were delighted to have spent quite a bit of time with FedEx and learned a lot from them about how they employed OR. And if you say again that OR is in the business of increasing your intelligence flow, in the case of the DOD, then that's one measure of merit. In the case of FedEx, they could give you all kinds of measures of merit. How many hours it takes to deliver so many packages, how much it costs them, what kind of trucks they need, what kind of airplanes they need, where they should have their airports located, how they schedule, how they train their drivers, how they decide to make only right-hand turns to save time. Mm-hmm. All those kind of things was a really interesting dynamic and case study for us as we saw how a commercial entity took these real issues on and said, okay, here's a problem for OR to use. Now, the next question was, where do I put my OR people? Do I put them off in an OR area under a line of business, which immediately starts making you suspect of the OR, the efficacy of the OR study, or do I make it a standalone capability and then don't provide it any coverage, in which case it's going to get no traction, or do I say it's got to stand alone, but it's got a daddy rabbit here in the CEO and the senior vice presidents or the big bosses are all going to listen to those reports, and the lines of business have to explain why they're not following those reports. So that's a very interesting model, and they kind of chose the latter. I'm giving you the scaled-down version, but by choosing that latter, they really got it into the mission of the company, which was saving dollars and producing it at a lower cost. And by having it as a standalone protected entity who reported to the decision makers, not under the thumb of the lines of business then had to explain why they were doing things the way they were doing them, why they didn't buy 10 of these airplanes instead of 30 of those airplanes, why the airport was built here, why the truck drivers drove this way instead of that way. So it was a very good case study to empirically show that you could measure more product for less money.
And that's something that DOD could apply.
We think so.
The report recommended that DOD launch test cases to further establish the utility of ops research and defense intelligence. And what were these test cases designed to test? What were you trying to prove?
Well, let me give you one of the examples. Back to the earlier model there, unmanned aerial vehicles mm-hmm. or remotely piloted aircraft, as we're talking about them now. Unmanned airplanes, do you want to have a big unmanned airplane that's very stealthy and therefore very survivable, or do you want to have a big, highly capable, long-endurance platform like a Global Hawk or a Predator that is not very survivable? It's got to operate in a certain medium, but it can't perform in a defense, highly defended area. So those are the kinds of things that we identify to say, okay, when you want to buy your force mix for the future, are you going to fight in an area where you have air defenses that can shoot you down if you're a Global Hawk, or in an area where you're not having good air defenses like Afghanistan, so you can use Global Hawk without any fear for losing them?
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Major General Richard O'Leary, co-chairman of the Defense Science Board Task Force that produced two reports about making better use of operations research and military intelligence. General, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. May I make one final statement?
Sure.
One of the things I would encourage all the folks who embrace OR as a vocation, as a passion, as a profession, if you can help the DOD work around this metrics issue. How do you measure outputs better on a very subjective thing like intelligence? It's a tough thing to do and something we've struggled with. if you can give some brain cells to that problem and surface those solutions to people in the intelligence community, that would be very valuable for the country.
A challenge to operations researchers. Thank you all for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.